You're welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's always good to be in the house of faith. Today is a day that we are, as a culture, reminded to honor the memory of one of the prophets of our culture, and that's Dr. Martin Luther King. And I thought that I would begin by reminding us of Dr. King's vision. For Dr. King, the beloved community was not a lofty utopian goal to be confused with the rapturous image of the peaceable kingdom in which lions and lambs coexist in idyllic harmony. Rather, the beloved community for him was a realistic, achievable goal that could be obtained by a critical mass of people committed to and trained in the philosophy and methods of nonviolence. Dr. King's beloved community is a global vision in which all people can share in the wealth of the earth, and the beloved community, poverty, hunger, and homelessness will not be tolerated because international community standards of human decency will not allow it. Racism and all forms of discrimination, bigotry, and prejudice will be replaced by an all-inclusive spirit of sisterhood and brotherhood. In the beloved community, international disputes will be resolved by peaceful conflict resolution and the reconciliation of adversaries instead of military power. Love and trust will triumph over fear and hatred. Peace and justice will prevail over war and military conflict. I'm reminded of one of our readings that is entitled Prophets, and it begins like this: always it is easier to pay homage to the prophets than to heed the direction of their vision. And I am suggesting today that we Unitarian Universalists, we are called to pay homage to the vision of Dr. King. And I thought I would begin by talking just a bit about racism and how racism is maintained in our culture and how racism is symptomatic of something even larger. Racism, it comes in two ways, I believe, in our culture. One, it is actually in the structures of our society. There is a preference for white in the structures of our society. And if you need an example of that, I would suggest that you go sit in any courtroom in this country and you will see there is a preference for white in this country. Another way racism happens is that there is a hate inside of the individual. And you think in your life, is there anything that happens or any subject that comes up where something inside of you just churns and you say, I hate that? It's a deep, gristle, tough, hard feeling. And I'm suggesting that there are times when we internalize and that deep feeling comes in our lives when we are very young and we don't understand what it is, but it's inside of us. And as we grow and as we get older, to make sense out of what's happening to our body and what's happening to our emotional life, we project that hate onto something. And I'm suggesting racism, at its core, receives the projection of our hate. Because when we back out and look, we would all certainly say and agree with the first principle. We covenant and promote and affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person. It's easy to say that. But how do we experience that first principle? How do we move in a culture that within its very nature is oppression, that moves toward a prejudice, that moves toward discrimination, that creates classism? How do we turn away from that culture and take a step and begin to walk toward the beloved community? Do our principles, do our values as Unitarian Universalists move us in the direction to turn and to walk toward the beloved community? Do those seven principles that we read do that? I am saying yes, indeed, they have the potential to do that. I am also saying that in order for that to happen, we need to experience the first principle. Not cognitively say it, not cognitively understand it, but we need to experience it. We need to experience the inherent worth and dignity of every person. We need to experience the covenant among ourselves to promote and affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person. It is an experience that we need to go through and that we need to struggle with. Now, how do we experience that? Because I'm suggesting that it is a difficult thing to do. And here's what I'm reminded of when I try to do that. I'm reminded of the people in my history that have betrayed me, that have offended me, that have hurt me, that have been absent when they should have been present. That first principle calls me to affirm their worth and dignity. I've spent a lot of years of resentment and hate and dislike for people in my history who have hurt me, who have betrayed me. Now my religious faith is calling me to affirm their worth and dignity. One step further. If in my memory, I have memories of these people, and when I memorize and when I call up those memories, and I can feel that resentment, or I can feel that hurt, or I can feel that hate, that's me that's hurting, that's feeling the hate. In a way, I'm doing it to myself because it is in my spiritual realm of the imagination. The first step in being able to experience that first principle is I must value myself. I must affirm myself. I must have a sense of dignity about who I am in this world and in this life. Do we have that, or do we bypass that part of the first principle? It is crucial to move in the direction of affirming and valuing ourselves. And how, I might say, of course I do that. Well, who wouldn't do that? Here's how we can tell whether we're on that spiritual path. If I have a critical internal voice, which I talk about sometimes, that judges me, if I have a sense of low self-esteem, in which that's a judgment against myself, these are indicators that I am not valuing myself, my whole self. Are there things that I have done and betrayed people? Are there things that I have done that I have not forgiven myself? If there are, then I'm not valuing my whole self. If I consider myself to be victim and I live in the sense of there was a genuine victimization, but I'm still caught in that trap and it's still happening to me in my life. Have I been the offender and have victimized somebody else? And that part of me that has done that, I lock up in a box and I never address and I never see and I never let out because I know if I let it out, it could do harm to others. So I try to control that, but periodically my control gives way. If I have this struggle, or if I've decided that's just the way it is in this world and that's just the way I'm going to be, that's my lot in life, that's how I'm going to live out my time, then I'm not struggling with the experience of that first principle. When we struggle with that experience, and when we begin to move in the direction of self-affirmation, of being valued, valuing myself, when I move in that direction, it is then that I am able to choose freely my own purpose in this world, my own direction in this world. And not until I come to terms with who I am, with self-affirmation, can I do that. Otherwise, I am living somebody else's story. What I mean by that, when you look through your history and you look at some of the things that have gone on in your life, if you were going to be the author of your story, would you have included those events? there are things in my life that if I were the author of my story, I would leave out. That lets me know that somebody else is the author of my story. And that is a crucial to come to terms with the ideas of self-affirmation and valuing of the self. We talked the last couple weeks about some traditions in Buddhism and about the beginning of the spiritual journey. And I am suggesting that to really become as clean as possible when we begin to make decisions for ourselves, when we begin to experience make sense of purpose for ourselves, and we begin to experience that struggle, one of the first steps is moving in the spiritual practice of letting go of my past and letting go of my future. We were working on the story called The Wounded Swan, and part of that story is how Buddha came to be Buddha. And in that story, when he first went into the woods and first started his spiritual journey into the woods, the first teacher he met taught him, the very first thing, told him, you must learn to breathe. You must learn to focus on your breath and control your breath. I haven't heard that in my places in the congregation in my early life. Never was taught that. But in the Buddhist tradition, that comes first, because the second thing the teacher told Buddha to struggle with was to, you must let go of your future and you must let go of your past. So the method in our tradition of Buddhism is begin to focus on our breathing. That's the method of that spiritual practice. But we also have a method of that spiritual practice in the Christian tradition. Not the Christian tradition that we've talked about, the Christian religion that began in the 4th century, that we come to understand that Christian tradition is infused with the value system of empire and imperialistic nature. That particular Christianity cannot let go of the future and the past, because they live in the future and the past, and the future and past drives them, drives that group. The Christianity that we're talking about, that we honor as Unitarian Universalisms, is the Christianity that is taught by the prophet of Jesus. We follow the teachings of Jesus, and we know that Jesus was in the line of the Old Testament prophets. That is the Christian tradition we follow. And in that Christian tradition has come to a method of spiritual practice called pastoral care and pastoral counseling. In that method, we are taught to reflect on our history, and we make the meaning of our history in terms of who we want to be in this world. And that's our Christian tradition, Christian methodology. When we get to the place that we can indeed let go of the past and let go of the future, and we can stand in the here and now, it is in that place we can freely choose who we want to be, how we want to be, and what community we want to belong to. When we say that we're Unitarian Universalists and we covenant and affirm the seven principles, spiritual maturity moves us in the direction where we stand in the here and now and we choose those principles. And we know when we choose those principles from a healthy position, because if we choose those principles from a healthy position, we are moved toward action. We are moved toward actualizing those principles in our lives. I like the concept of, are we living out of the seven principles? And what that means is, are the seven principles and is our tradition alive in us, so that as I interact in this world, I'm congruent with those principles. I'm congruent with covenant and affirming the inherent worth of every person, which includes myself. Those values aren't just words. Those values are alive within us, and they guide our direction in this world. And I'm suggesting that when that happens, we can speak with dignity, we can understand with dignity, and we can stand with dignity. When we author our own story and we make our choices in our lives and we choose a particular value system that moves within us, it gives us the power to stand, to speak, and understand with dignity. To stand with dignity means that I am not double-minded, that I am not given to guilt and shame, that I am not gripped by fear of the future. I am of single mind when I stand and I speak. Understanding with dignity is a curious thing. If I have a particular belief, and I read and I study, and I discover that belief was wrong, but it's important for me to have that belief to belong to a community, and I continue to act as if I haven't learned that I no longer believe that, I am not understanding with dignity. I can remember the first church I went to when I was 17 years old. It was a fundamentalist church. The pastor, whom I really liked and played football and wrestled with his son, so I got to know him more than just pastor, he got into a training process. And that church believed in, if some of you are familiar with, the rapture, the end times, where people get removed from the earth. That was the theology of that church. He got into a training process called clinical pastoral education. That training process is in line with the Christian tradition that we honor. It forces you, if you're going to be in that training process, to reflect and make meaning. And as he reflected and made meaning of who he is and who he was as a minister, he came to learn that that particular theology did not exist prior to 1826. It was introduced into our culture in 1826 and was actually considered a fringe belief. Okay? He had a choice at that time. If he would have continued in that church, and it was a growing church, it was a prosperous church, they were right on the edge of starting their school. It was wonderful, and we all loved it. Youth group of over 70 kids. If he would have continued to preach that particular eschatology, that particular view on the end times, he would not have understood with dignity. Because understanding with dignity moves us to a behavior that's congruent with what we know to be true. Doesn't mean it doesn't change in the future, but today we know it to be true. What he did, he resigned from that church. And that was the right decision, because that church would have never moved away from that particular theology. Never. It would have split that church, and it would have done harm to that church if he had stayed there and tried to move that church in that direction. So in a sense, there was dignity in that understanding. It was a sacrificial move to give up a very good place in life. How are we to speak, to stand, and to understand with dignity in a culture that puts a pseudo-dignity in front of our face? And what I mean by pseudo-dignity in front of our face, we have people of a religious conviction that have an instant conversion, but yet still affirm values that have violence within them. We have political figures that get on television and tell us they did not do these things, and yet we find out they did do these things. We have people in the most powerful positions of the world looking at us through the television, looking us in the eye, so to speak, telling us one thing here and implementing practices and legislation over here that's different than what they tell us. Pseudo-dignity. There's no honor in that. Recently down in Port St. Lucie, their Florida Power and Light was trying to build a coal plant, and they had to make their presentation to the city council, county council. And in their presentation, they were confronted with this. This coal plant will put out 200 pounds of mercury per year. Their response was, the smokestacks are going to be so high, 700 feet high, so as I open my door, I'm seeing smokestacks, 700 feet high, that the mercury would not fall on the citizens of Port St. Lucie. Okay. Somehow, these are the leaders of our culture. These are the corporations that are moving legislation through our culture. There is no dignity, there is no honor in that particular position. It is an evil position. It is a position that says money is worth more than people. We are now in a place where thousands of our young people, thousands of people are in a war of aggression that is questionable why we went to war. Questionable why we went to war, and yet they are there. How are we to honor and have dignity of the culture that we were in when we are confronted with such contradictions, when we are confronted with such deceit? We as Unitarian Universalists, as liberal religious people, we must stand with dignity. We must speak with dignity. We must be of single-minded. We must understand with dignity as we present our voice to this culture. In our silence, we are shamed. We are shamed if we are silent. Yet, with our voice speaking, we can claim our dignity. We can confront the incongruencies. We can confront the denials. We can claim who we are with a tradition that is prophetic, that has continuously, since the birth of Unitarian Universalism, confronted oppression in a culture. We can claim who we truly are, and we can have a voice that confronts the evil, the greed, and the disregard for human life in our culture. We indeed can claim our principles, live out of our principles, know ourselves as having worth and dignity first. Then, as a result of that, being able to recognize dignity and worth in others outside of who we are. Recognize false dignity. Speak to it, address to it. If we are committed and we do indeed covenant to the principles and the first principle, not necessarily in cognitive agreement, but experience that first principle with one another, creating a community where we can move into our own selves and discover those parts of ourselves that we have trouble with liking, that we have trouble with having a sense of worth about. Developing a community so that we can covet to build a community that's emotionally safe where we can do that. And we have done that in some groups. The Breaking the Bad Habits group is one of them. We do provide areas in which to do that. But if we're not covenanting experientially with one another, it will not happen. So when we read those words, we covenant, we need to feel covenant. We need to get a sense of what that means. Because when we feel it and we get a sense of what that means, we begin to connect to one another. We begin to care for one another. We begin to be concerned for one another. Coming from that base, coming from that foundation, no matter what culture we live in, no matter how false it is, contradictory it is, based on fear it is, no matter what that's like, our voice can have dignity, and we can indeed turn and begin to walk toward that beloved community. We need to take the next right step.